Okay, welcome back to another episode of Firewall. As usual, I'm your host, Bradley Tusk. With us today is a public health expert that I think is particularly well suited to our podcast because I think he really understands politics as well and sort of the intersection of what's happening and what it means for democracy, elections, public policy, the economy, everything else is particularly, I think, interesting to me and to your listeners as well. So, Dr. Abdullah Saeed, thank you so much for joining us. We're really honored to have you on.
Bradley, thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here with you.
I could ask you to give your background, but I'm going to do it because if you did it, I suspect you would be very modest. And it's pretty phenomenally impressive. You're a physician, an epidemiologist, public health expert. You're a Rhodes Scholar. You were the health director of the city of Detroit at the age of 30. You went to Columbia Medical School. You host your own podcast called America Dissected Coronavirus. You comment on CNN. And especially interesting for us is in 2018, you ran for governor of Michigan as a progressive, universal health care, clean water for all, which given Flint, I imagine, was a major issue, free tuition, renewable energy. So and got the support of people like Sanders and AOC and kind of the DSA world there. You wrote a book that came out this March called Healing Politics, A Doctor's Journey to the Heart of Our Political Pandemic, which, I really want to get into because it talks about, in your view, what the real crisis is in this country. Is it a health epidemic or is it kind of a psychological epidemic in a way? Congrats on everything you've accomplished so far. And, why don't we just kick it off with, where do you think we are at this moment? We're recording this on October 7th. It felt like things were better. Now they seem to feel worse from a public health standpoint. How are you thinking about it?
Well, I'll tell you, it really is a moment of reckoning for our country, a moment where we decide who we are and who we want to be. And I think every election is really a referendum on those two questions. But in this moment, some of the worst circumstances of our history have really hit a crescendo. As an epidemiologist, I sort of think about this as a set of interlocking epidemics or pandemics. The coronavirus pandemic is the most obvious one. It's already taken 210,000 lives. But the other pandemic that we have been dealing with for 400 years in this country is the pandemic of systemic racism. And there was a study by David Satcher, who was the Surgeon General under Bill Clinton. And he asked a very simple question. He said, how many lives would we save in America every year if we were able to lower the mortality rate among Black Americans just so that it was the same as white Americans? And he estimated that we'd save 83,000 lives a year. Now, think about what 83,000 lives looks like over the course of 400 years. And that pandemic is still ongoing. And then there's the third epidemic, which I wrote about in the book, of course, before coronavirus was a thing, which is this epidemic of insecurity. And what I mean by that is we are suffering as a nation and individually this subjective feeling of fear and anxiety about our futures and the futures of our children. But it is undergirded by a subtext of watching the basic systems that we've relied upon to deliver the basic means of a dignified life for a long time, whether it's the housing system or the healthcare system or our basic infrastructure or our economy or our political system, get sold off to the highest bidder, corporations who have, in effect, just excluded the poorest of us and then extracted from the rest of us. And we've watched as those systems have crumbled before our eyes for the past 40 years, such that we are conditioned by loss to expect a loss and to fear it. And so all of these together shape this moment. And we have a choice, a very clear choice in November about who we are and who we want to be, but a choice every day after that election. About the same set of things. And it's going to require a lot of work, I think, to heal all of these pandemics, some more acute than others, but certainly some more profound and effectual to the day-to-day lived experience of all of us than others.
Right. It's really interesting that you get to that because, there's this sort of, on the MAGA side, sort of this nostalgia for sort of a 1950s America that I guess for some people were pretty well. And by the way, you even see that on the on the far left a little bit too. Like we had a professor from Yale Law School on who talked about, wrote the book called The Meritocracy Trap, and he talked about how much better a kind of middle class community in Michigan was, you know, in the 1950s and 60s than it is today. But at the same time, you know, we live in a world right now where it is far more complicated. We are having to deal with lots of hard issues, right, around racial equality, around income inequality, around climate. Were we better off when these issues were all kind of buried underneath the surface, but it didn't feel quite as divisive? Or is the divisiveness we have now just the natural conclusion of people achieving full rights and really wanting full recognition?
That's an interesting question, and I think it is I think about the fact that under Donald Trump's presidency, he has in so many ways worn off the varnish on a set of broken systems in a ways that has forced all of us to actually look at them and decide what we're going to do about it. And I think the choice, right, that a lot of folks are implicitly making is whether or not we want to put that varnish back on, or we want to deal with the structural brokenness of these systems. And what I'm seeing is a lot of people who are saying, no. It's not okay to allow the worst of these systems to fester a la Donald Trump. But it's also not okay to put the varnish back on and pretend like these weren't issues. Because you're right, you know, you look at the history of our country, and for a selected group of people, things were better in the past. But for a lot of people, they were substantially worse. And one of the things that's happening in our country is that we are answering the question about whether or not, you know, we can be a truly multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-faith society and still preserve the nature of our democracy. And so that is happening in the context of a lot of change, both demographically, but also technologically, that has changed the nature of work, and also a setting of deep and profound inequality, because we have sort of taken the reins off of the power of corporations. All of these trends are intersecting at the same time, which makes this a really tenuous moment. And yet, I actually think there's a lot to be hopeful for. And the reason I'm so hopeful it's because I spend a lot of my time talking to young folks, and young folks see the challenges for what they are. They see the varnish for what it is, and they recognize that harking for a past isn't what's going to get us to the future that we need to build that truly does protect the kind of equity and the kind of justice and the kind of sustainability that we have needed and have it at times had, but for everyone in an equitable way, and in a way that's honest with our opportunities and our limitations.
So can you point to any, not that it's your responsibility, but any kind of democracy in history that was this kind of multicultural and managed to actually succeed? And then the second question is, does it really matter? So you talk about young people. My daughter is 14. She's a climate activist. She's busy in in XR and a whole bunch of other groups, and she would certainly say that the most important thing from her perspective we could do is take really material action on climate, except it's not too late. But if I said to her, hey, this could either happen, it could definitely happen, but let's say we're, instead of being one country, we're now five countries and it happens in three of them, or we kind of have the status quo fighting, but we remain one country, I think she would say, like, all right, let's have five countries. What do I care? So is there an example where the vision you're talking about has worked? And, like, is it that important that it does work? Or are we better off just splitting up into smaller subgroups?
Well, I will say that it does matter that it does work. And the reason it does matter is because, if you look at the values that will drive the future of our world, I do believe that our ability to get through this moment and to demonstrate what is possible when people who look different and pray different and maybe have different histories can come together and share power. I think that the example of that for the world matters more today than it ever has. And part of that is because we're seeing as country after country is falling to authoritarianism and authoritarian leaders who want to pull back on the rights of individuals and want to push forward on a majoritarian, very dangerous ethno-nationalistic viewpoint. And unfortunately, right, Trumpism is that in the United States. And our ability to get through it and move beyond it, I think, tells the world that it is possible and that it matters. And so, yes, it does matter. It matters a lot. I look at the values of other ascendant countries, right? The ways that Xi Jinping in China has dominated the Uyghur minority in Xinjiang province, and I look at the way that that Vladimir Putin has dealt with dissidents in his country, and I think that if those values were to really set the standard worldwide, that the whole world would be worse off for it. So that's number one. Number two, I will say that what we've done in America itself is already unprecedented. And so the fact that, we cannot find an analog in global history to what we have already done, I think is probably not the indicator. The question is, are we able in this moment to set a precedent and to do so by recognizing that there has been deep injustice in our society, that we have to fix it, and that the only way around it is through it, but also believing in what's come before us and our country's ability to correct. I just, I worry a lot as a kid who shuttled back and forth between the United States and Egypt many summers in my childhood. I worry a lot about what happens when we assent to, strongman dictatorships and what is lost in terms of what there is to believe in this country. And so I would argue to both you and your daughter that it is possible and that it matters and that we have the opportunity to show the world something it's never seen. And I know that we should not be missing that opportunity.
So I would argue, let's see if you agree or disagree, that everything you just said is both right and achievable, but only if there is major structural reform in the political system. And that, so I spent the first 15 years of my career working in city government, state government, federal government, executive branch, legislative branch, running campaigns. So I feel like I've seen the political system from all angles. And the takeaway I had from all of it is, every policy output is shaped by a political input. And I believe the vast, vast majority of people who hold office can't live without the validation and affirmation that comes with holding office. There's almost a hole in their psyche. And that affirmation fills it and it makes them feel like they're somebody. And by the way, my guess is that was true in the Greek Senate, the Roman Senate. That's just the human nature of most candidates for office. The only exception I saw was, when I both worked for Matt Bloomberg at City Hall and ran his mayoral campaign, he was different. But he was also already 60 years old and a billionaire before he got into it. So he came at it from a different perspective, too. But other than Mike, whether they were good people or bad people, they all had the same underlying kind of need to fill that hole in their psyche, which means asking them to take votes that are against their political interests, or like asking you or me to go without oxygen or water. It's just not going to happen. Right. And to expect them to do it is foolish. Right. It's kind of like when there's a mass shooting, there's lots of hopes and prayers and vigils, and then the assault weapon ban never passes. Because if you're the Republican congressman from, Central Florida and turnout in your primary is 12% and half that 12% are NRA members, and because the gerrymandering, the primary is the only election that matters, you probably know that an assault weapon ban is the right thing to do. But a lot of these massacres have happened in your state. But for as long as voting for it means sacrificing your seat in the next election, you're not going to do it. And they don't do it, right? And so I would argue that that there is the ability to bring the kind of consensus you're talking about in a world where truly multicultural way, people can prove that they can work together, but only the interests of the majority are the relevant political interests in the first place, right? And for as long as the interests of the 10 to 12% that vote in primaries on the far left and far right are dictating what politicians do, then all of their incentives are to do nothing and to fight, because the people who show up and actually vote in the election that matters to them, that's how they feel. So I would argue, until we have something like mobile voting, and my foundation spending a lot of time and money trying to make that happen, where it is really, really easy to vote and really secure to vote, we're always going to have sort of primaries with tiny, tiny turnout, and primaries because of gerrymandering are the only election that really matters. And as a result, the kind of vision you're talking about is impossible to achieve. That was a lot to say, but what do you think about all that?
Well, I would argue, I agree that we fundamentally do need structural change in our politics. I spent a lot of the book talking about that. I mean, the book is called Healing Politics, right? And we named it that on purpose because I do think that it is our political structure around the ways in which money has so dominated the way that that politicians behave. That I actually think that that's the structural failing. So, you know, I agree with you, right? You have deep gerrymandering that profoundly reshapes the kind of votes that a politician may be willing to take. You have, circumstances where our public conversation is mediated via social media that tend to amplify the furthest extremes of that conversation and hijack it. But the place where I will push is to say that since Citizens United, the amount of money that can move untracked from corporate coffers into both electioneering and lobbying has so changed the set of conversations that are had in halls of power that oftentimes people in politics are less worried about where their votes are going to come from than they are worried about where the money to sway votes is going to come from. And if we are serious about maintaining a firewall between our politics and our economics in ways that don't allow major corporations to rent seek, right, to dictate the rules of the game that they're playing, then we're going to have to rethink that aspect of it. And, you know, that's why I do believe that that rethinking campaign finance and doing so in a way that eliminates the power of both corporate money, of personal money, from being able to sway voter and voter opinion, and our ability also to change the nature of our public conversation by stopping social media companies from being able to profiteer off of a broken public conversation in a way that, you know, gives, you know, I believe everybody has the right to freedom of speech, but I don't believe that you have the right to buy a bunch of bots who then echo your speech to everybody you want to hear it, right?
Yeah.
And I think if we're able to reform those aspects of our public conversation and our political system, then we can get things moving on the right track. But you're right, right? The structure of our politics is what's yielding these broken outcomes. And I'll just step back to say that, you know, when I ran for office, I believed deeply in the power of politics to shape policy. Since having run and having watched another cycle of which I was not an explicit part, I've come to believe that I actually think that the work of politics is to translate our culture into our policy. And some politicians, they work by being able to move our culture, and some work by being able to really, really translate that culture into policy. But so long as our culture tends to be hijacked by people who want to advertise this stuff, and so long as our politics continue to be hijacked by corporations that want to sell us stuff, you're going to keep seeing a politics that is both disjunct from our culture and disjunct from the policy that we need to answer it.
I think that's fair. And I think, you know, look, I would agree. I mean, we certainly should overturn Citizens United if at all possible, although the current makeup of the court and the likely, I would argue, confirmation of Coney Barrett's not going to help on that front. But also at the same time, one of the reasons why the money matters so much is when turnout is really, really low, you're only talking about trying to influence small groups of voters, and therefore the money is especially potent. If turnout at primary went from 12% to 60%, it really diffuses the money a lot, because now you've got to reach so many more people, right? And it's harder to do. One minor cause for optimism is it is possible that simply the advent of technology in some ways may make politics a little less expensive. I'm sure when you ran for governor, the primary thing your consultants are really telling you is raise more money, you got to go on TV. TV is incredibly expensive. It's like 80% of the spend in most major races. But fewer and fewer people actually watch live TV, right? Or watch TV commercials at all. It may be that the advent of Netflix and all the different streaming platforms kind of eliminates live TV effectively. And as a result, the efficacy of TV ads become a lot lower. The ROI goes way down. And while the political world will seek to sort of fill the vacuum by spending it on digital ads and other things, you know, just the nature of TV advertising is going to be so much more expensive always than the nature of digital advertising, that you could see a world, due to no credit on our part whatsoever, money goes down simply because the technology reduces the cost of running campaigns.
I wonder, though, I'd love to think through, you're someone who's thought through this a lot more than I have, but I'd love to think through what the potential unintended consequences of more and more of that advertising spend going digital is, because I think the thing about a television ad is that you're still advertising to everyone. And so your ad still cannot, it cannot be, you're both trying to, you know, persuade voters to come out for you who are still in the middle, also turn out voters who want to support you to make sure that they come out and vote. But you also don't want to give your opponents too much to make a fuss about. The problem with online digital advertising is that it's so well targeted that you can imagine more and more tailored messaging that tends to amplify at the extremes, because there isn't the potential cost of having to advertise to everybody, right? And I worry about how that might continue to polarize both messaging and then also political bases, when you basically said, look, all we really have to do is turn out this group of people and appeal to this group of people, and that's it, right? Rather than saying, actually, this is a message that has to speak to everybody, in getting politicians to, in effect, give up on another group.
Right, totally. And that's where I guess the structural reform comes back in. So, for example, I live in New York. Next year, our municipal elections will have ranked choice voting for the first time. The argument for ranked choice voting is to do what you just said, which is to force candidates to appeal to lots of voters as opposed to small groups of voters, simply because being the second or third or fourth choice, you know, matters a lot too. Or again, if you had radically higher turnout, then that would also probably force you a little more towards the center. Or if we get a gerrymandering, but the Supreme Court seems really unlikely to do that as well. You're an expert in Michigan politics. How confident are you that Biden went to Michigan?
Look, I feel pretty good about it, but I've learned enough as watching campaigns that polling is a very, very difficult thing to do these days.
Yes.
That I just don't take anything for granted. My group, Southpaw Michigan, is involved in a major voter outreach effort to, you know, voters who may not have been happy with the outcome of the primary, may be less likely to vote simply as a matter of demographic. And, you know, we're reaching out to 400,000 people on the phone and 2 million people by text. And we're trying our best. And I think everybody's sort of in the same boat. Like, we're not going to let off until election day. I feel good, but I'll tell you how I feel on you know, November 11th, hopefully, when this whole thing is finally behind us.
And that may be optimistic. I hope you're right.
You know, I do want to speak to a point that you made earlier, which I think is an interesting one, which is the question of the middle, right? Because I think we have a responsibility, and I've been making this argument to progressives. We have a responsibility both to bring our politics closer in rather than polarize, and also move the middle. And so, you know, a lot of the work that I've tried to do is to take, you know, ideas that people tend to identify as being left ideas and speak to them at core, because I don't believe in ideology, honestly. I don't come to my politics as an ideologue. I'm a scientist. I'm too much of a scientist to believe in any real dogma. And so I bring to my politics a sense of, like, what would actually solve the set of problems that I care about, that I saw people suffer when I was health director in the city of Detroit. And so there is sort of this hallowed space of talking about a middle, when, you know, we have to remember that the middle in America has been held in one place, or held to a particular space, largely because of all of the misplaced advertising and frankly, you know, dogmatic dog whistles that we've already seen, right? So the question about like healthcare, which is an issue of great importance to me, right? There is this sense that, you know, the middle approach has to include this large private health insurance industry, which serves nothing but to provide a middleman off of which a lot of people make a lot of money. And so like the idea that that's the middle to me is a function more of the fact that we've corrupted the middle than it is of this notion that it is a thoughtful and, you know, and state approach that appeals to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually a really interesting point. I'm not sure I've looked at it that way before. I want to finish in a slightly different direction, which is I want to draw on your perspective as an epidemiologist more so than a political activist, which is the whole White House has COVID. The Joint Chiefs of Staff have COVID. This would seem to me, and I'm not a military expert in the slightest, but like kind of a good time to attack if all of your leadership is down. Do you worry about pandemics becoming weaponized and being used proactively as a way to kind of create, you know, all kinds of hardship in different ways?
I mean, it is a scenario that I think all of us in the public health world have been forced to think through, particularly now and particularly under this leadership. I mean, you know, even before Donald Trump had COVID-19, it was very clear that COVID-19 was a clear risk to him because he's deeply ineffectual, and he's now struggling with trying to maintain the levers of government in the middle of chaos, right? And you take a bad leader and you throw him in a chaos situation, they become an even worse leader. And so, you know, now, right, the White House has COVID-19, the Joint Chiefs have COVID-19, and the consequences could be really dire. And, you know, the thing I want folks to understand about this is, you know, this isn't like a sort of cleaning your drains, right? You do it once and then you're done with for a while. No, the fact that we've just come through COVID-19 does not mean that that we could not see another even worse pandemic 2 years from now, right? And it doesn't mean that we will see one 2 years from now. I mean, it could be 100 years again. But you look at what's happening with climate change, and you look at the degree and the density of globalization and the consequences that it's had for our economies, that we are more and more susceptible to another bad pandemic. And we've got to make sure that as we come out of this one, that we prepare for the next one like it's coming 2 years from now. Right, because it very well might. And that includes really thinking about the geopolitical consequences of a pandemic and the realignment that happens, that's already happened in the context of this one and potentially a next one. And so we really do have to be thinking about never again with this one, because the consequences of the next one could be even worse.
Yeah, right. You could have the same disruption, but with a vastly higher actual, you know, mortality rate and everything else. Yeah. So look, yet another argument. I can't imagine anyone listening to this podcast is not voting for Joe Biden, but another argument to do so if you're still on the fence somehow. Dr. Abdullah Al-Sayed, thank you so much for joining us. This was fantastic.
Bradley, it was my privilege, and thank you for the work that you do, and looking forward to staying in touch. Okay.
You too. Yeah, sure.